Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello, welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and myself, Tris Dixon. We have said that this week's show we will put out to you, the listeners, and we are taking some questions and we've got plenty in. Before I get to them, actually, gents, you'll be pleased to know that we've had a couple of reviews and they're really positive, actually. Someone said, So this is from In Character, who wrote this before Christmas, so during the season of Goodwill. Your lineup of dream fights was very good. I'm sure there are many dream fights that could have made the list, but one dream fight that I think would have been great, we can start off with this, is Roberto Duran versus Manny Pacquiao. I would dub the fight as Fists of Fury, and they'd be fighting in the lightweight division, which we all know Duran was king at. I don't think it would have gone 12 rounds, let alone 15. I'd love to hear your take and expert opinion on the outcome of this dream fight. Welcome back, Ringside Rewind. Ian.
Yeah, well, you only read out the good reviews, Tris. I mean, what about all the people who did assassination jobs on us?
Well, I think there's only one up there at the minute. And also, I don't think that was left about our podcast because it didn't seem right in some way, shape or form. So
that was my wife who wrote in the criticism one.
I thought she was praising you, so you'd spend more time out here on the Zoom. than in the house with her. So, Ian, Duran Pacquiao, great fight.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. What a fantastic fight. You wouldn't need anything else on that bill, would you? People would travel millions of miles. I think people would get on spacecraft from Mars and Jupiter to come and see this. It would be fantastic. Why didn't we think of that? He's right, isn't he? Fists of Fury. I mean, that almost doesn't cover how great that could be, especially at lightweight. Imagine Roberto Duran in his peak years when he was young, a young man, and Pacquiao, who was just perpetual motion with his fists, wasn't he? So not last 12 rounds. I'm not sure it would have lasted five, but don't ask me who would have won. No idea. Absolutely no idea.
It's certainly one you'd have wanted to have seen, isn't it? I mean, it's got everything, absolutely everything. I kind of lean slightly towards Duran simply because I believe he's probably the greatest lightweight that we've seen in our lifetime. And I think that his precision, his sheer aggression would perhaps have taken it. I don't know. I mean, it's a really difficult call, Tris.
Yeah, I mean, go on, Ian.
No, I was just going to say, he wouldn't have turned his back on Pacquiao, would he? That's for sure. Well, that's a cheap shot, isn't it? That's a cheap shot.
Ian, you know, I was going to go there because Pacquiao was so quick. I'm not sure he wasn't quicker of foot speed than Ray Leonard in terms of getting in and out. He could well have bamboozled Duran, but also he could have got too involved and been caught with a sickening shot to the body and stopped early. Terrific fight. By the way, there's another review here, and this is from Easy Does It, which suits us. It's much more our speed that. It says, absolute must for any boxing fan looking for a bit of nostalgia and opinions on sport these days from the best commentators who covered all the best domestic and super fights, Ian Dark and John Rawling, and journalist Tris Dixon during the heyday for boxing before streaming platforms have taken over. Yeah. When was our heyday, gents?
I think he was just trying to tell us we're past it, basically. It's a very nice way of saying you're past it.
Oh, dear. Right, well, let's get to this. Before this, by the way, Ahmet Champaneri's written in, and he said, fascinating first Ringside Rewind, gents, on dream fights. My question is, what one super fight in boxing would you make right now? John, let's go with you. What super fight would you make right now?
That's a difficult one, isn't it? I'd be looking for a big one at welterweight. I'd be looking for somebody there for Crawford, and maybe one of the lads stepping up. I think that's, you know, there's been talk about him stepping up to fight Canelo, but I think Canelo's best days are behind him. I'd like to see, you know, the likes of maybe Haney, these sort of guys moving.
Yeah, Jaron Ennis, yeah.
There's Boots Ennis, the Philadelphian, who's probably the top welterweight, who's not named Terence Crawford. But yeah, like you said, you've got the guys Haney and those guys, they're campaigning at 140 now, but they're all going to be knocking on the door. And, you know, people are talking about Crawford leaping up to Canelo. Well, there's nothing to stop a Tank Davis leaping up to fight a Crawford, I suppose.
Yeah. That's a good fight. I mean, I think there are a few out there, aren't there, having got a bit of notice this question and rooted around. I definitely don't want to see KSI against anybody. I don't want to see Floyd Mayweather Pacquiao exhibition fight. Not interested remotely. I don't want to now see Deontay Wilder against anyone either, because he was technically an embarrassment last time out. So for me, that's him finished in the heavyweight division. Don't want to see him in any kind of fight with AJ. What about the Zhang, the Chinese heavyweight? I know he's 40, against AJ. Now that's a good fight, isn't it?
And you know,
who doesn't,
I mean,
want to see that?
I've been speaking to people about this recently. Imagine it in the bird's nest in China. What a spectacle.
Yeah. I mean, crikey, what would be the pay-per-view in China alone? Do they do pay-per-view in China? Probably not. But, I mean, the whole of China would be tuned in. I mean, obviously he wants that fight because it's a huge money fight for him. But, you know, who knows what might happen there? You know, he's had those two wins over Joe Joyce. I don't think anybody expected him to be doing that to Joe Joyce.
No, sure. No,
he seems to be a little bit avoided, doesn't he? I mean, when people start calling out for potential heavyweight fights, Zhang seems to be conveniently forgotten right now, or deliberately forgotten.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
what about 175 pounds? Better Biev against Bivol. That's good, isn't it? It's a trade fight, isn't it? I mean, it depresses me a little bit that we had that great fight this year. Well, it was on paper a great fight. I mean, Terence Crawford was sensational, you know, in beating Errol Spence in that fight, but it was a trade fight. I mean, that's a worry. It didn't get more coverage than it got worldwide. But, and I think this one too, Better Be Ever against Bivol. I mean, the boxing fans would go crazy for it, but the casuals, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think the issue now is Beterbiev, he's got Callum Smith in a couple of weeks' time, and you know, people are saying that, you know, Beterbiev is 38, 39. He's knocking on. We might have missed our window for that, as we seem to be doing a lot of the time. But hey, I love the big British fights, and, you know, although we're almost at saturation point with it, but I could still make time to go and watch AJ against Fury at Wembley. Although most likely you'd be heading to Saudi, but AJ Fury, there's still meat on the bone for that fight, particularly if Fury comes through Usyk and looks impressive, because AJ did look very impressive against Otto Wallin.
I mean, is anything going to be at Wembley? Again, it's all going to be in Saudi Arabia, isn't it? And which is, you know, you say what you like about that last bill there. I mean, obviously they all made a load of money, but it was soulless, wasn't it? Having to give some of the seats away, weren't they?
I heard somebody taking Frank Warren to task about that on TalkSport, Simon Jordan, I think. And Frank didn't like the line of questioning. He was sort of saying, well, why are we talking about a crowd? We should be talking about fights. And the Saudi Arabia productions are making big fights to be made. In other words, money is ruling over all. But, you know, I actually... You know, without wishing to go to war on this, I think Simon's got a point there, because I don't like watching a boxing match with no atmosphere. You know, it's going back to your Tyson fight in Tokyo, isn't it? Where people are sitting there applauding rather than cheering. I think you want to be in an arena where the crowd is really invested in what's going on inside the ropes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was always great, wasn't it, at the, you know, the MEN Arena, don't know what they're calling it now, in Manchester, when on a Ricky Hatton night, and the big bills they had there. And of course, you know, the great Vegas venues, my favorites, were always sitting outside on a balmy night under the stars with people maybe sipping cocktails and things in the background, you know, and you got a fight like Hagler and Hearns or Leonard and somebody in the ring. I mean, you can't top that. But you're not going to get that, really, are you? I don't think you're going to get that in Saudi Arabia.
So I think, do you know, I think one of the things we realized from the pandemic was how important as a spectacle the crowd is. And whether it's football or any other sport, I think it's vital that you've got a crowd that's buying into what they're watching and are invested in it. And I'm not sure that we've experienced that yet through the TV watching the fights from Saudi Arabia.
I commented on a fair few behind closed doors during that COVID era, you know, in the BT studios and other places, which were just set up for a fight. And they're essentially gym fights, really. And I tell you what, it was a bloody difficult job to commentate with no crowd.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, because everything sparks off that. I remember an American producer saying to me one day, I didn't believe everything he said or agree with everything he said, but you know what he said? When the camera's pointing and I see empty seats, I'm thinking, well, they're not interested in this. Why should I be?
Yeah. Well, you know what they could do? They could always pipe in the crowd noise and you can have the option like we did in the pandemic. That was a thing, wasn't it? Blimey.
Yeah, don't give them ideas, Tris.
Yeah. They'll Photoshop the crowd in next.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, Amit had his picks here. He made us, he said predictions were Naz would have beaten McGuigan by stoppage. Eubank would have stopped Minter. Calzaghe would have beaten Froch on points. Tyson would have KO'd Joe Frazier.
Yeah.
And Lennox would have outpointed Fury. So some good takes there from Amit.
He can come again. He's a good viewer, listener. Thank you.
Mike Hills has asked a couple here, so we'll get to the top couple of these. I think Mike Hill says, I'd like to know the top matches you wish you'd attended, and then how boxing shows have, we'll go to this, the biggest shocks you've witnessed. So I'd like to know the top matches you wish you'd attended and the biggest shocks you've witnessed. I mean, while you guys think about that, I will never forget that I covered the second fight between Miguel Cotto and Antonio Margarito, and I really wanted to do the first, and I was offered to do it by Claude at Boxing News. Mm. And I couldn't go because I was at a christening where I was going to be made someone's godfather. And I actually asked if they would adjust the date of the christening. And I think they thought I was joking, and I kind of was, but I was also kind of hopeful they might move the date. Also, there was another, I mean, Froch Groves has obviously gone down as a notoriously great fight. And I think the fight that I went to was Pacquiao Brandon Rios in China that night. And that was a historically bad call to go to that fight because of what happened in Manchester for Froch Groves. So those two stand out as ones that I missed that I should have gone to. But I don't know about you, Ian, what top matches you'd wish you'd attended? I suppose they can be historically significant here.
Yeah, yeah. I'll give you three. I'm going number one, Joe Louis against Max Schmeling, 1938. Wish I'd been there for that. Two, I mean, these are easy. Rumble in the Jungle. That was too soon, even for me. Three, Thriller in Manila. Not a bad list, is it?
Okay,
well,
John.
I tell you, I'd go along with some of those of Ian's there. I'd have liked to have seen any big fight with Jack Dempsey. Just to have got a taste of the atmosphere back in the 20s when he was just huge. But, Ian did Hagler Hearns. I'd have loved to have seen that. You know, I mean, I'm so fresh-faced and youthful that I didn't go to that one. But if I could travel in time and sort of add a few years, I envy people like Colin Hart who were there at Madison Square Garden when Muhammad Ali, for the first time, squared up against Joe Frazier. It might not have been the greatest fight, but the build-up and everything associated with it was just stunning. And I'd have liked to have been there. And having read your book, Ian, Triz, about Matthew Muhammad, I quite wish that I'd been ringside to see some of his. I guess he was somebody who left a very deep imprint on you.
Yeah, and you know, you can buy that book, Warrior, now, by the way.
Buy it
now.
Buy it today. Christmas, buy it now.
To be fair, Matthew was in so many great fights. You know, the Richie Cates fight where they were both floored and nearly out and both saved by the bell in back-to-back rounds. And the first war in particular with Marvin Johnson, which you've got people like Russell Peltz and Nigel Collins that have been in the sport for 50-odd years, 50, 60 years, and they say, you know, that nothing else has come close to that night. And they've been at most of the major fights. So, yeah, I mean, Matthew would have been up there. But I am with you, John. The fight of the century, the original one, 1971, in Madison Square Garden, that would have been an absolute pearler to have just, to have just been, to have seen the extravagant fur coats and the dresses and everything else that we've
Diana
heard about.
Diana Ross at ring. Frank Sinatra doing photos. Yeah, amazing, wasn't it? Incredible.
That would be great.
I should have put that on my list as well. Sorry, yeah, but you two covered the bases. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, he talks about shocks, doesn't he, as well?
Yes.
Biggest shocks, does Mike? Well, mine's easy, isn't it? I was at, Mike Tyson, Buster Douglas. You know, that is the mother of all shocks, isn't it? 42-1 and all that. So, yeah. I mean, on a domestic level, the one that sort of sprang to mind was Amir Khan. You know, he was being built up as, golden boy, Olympic star, all that stuff. And then Bradis Prescott, who we kind of never heard of, blows him away in 54 seconds. So that was kind of a stunner, absolute stunner. I think everybody was a little bit shell-shocked, not least Amir himself. So there's a couple.
That Prescott one might have been the one, my one, actually, Prescott Khan. I can't remember anything being as shocking as that.
I think Honeygun against Curry was a fairly massive shock, wasn't it? And a great performance as well. You know,
were you at that, John? Did you go to that? You didn't go to that, did you? I didn't. Des Lynam covered that, I think that was the last fight Des Lynam covered for BBC Radio. I was on holiday and he stepped in to do the commentary, so my timing was bad.
I did Ben McClellan, and Ben was a proper underdog for that one. I think a lot of people thought that McClellan had just been brought in to get Ben out of the way because he was becoming a bit awkward to promote and shouting his mouth off and not very easy to be around. And I think there was a feeling that that McClellan had brought in to steamroller him. And of course, Nigel was only too well aware of that one. And that was one of his inspirations for producing that phenomenal performance. The fight's kind of been airbrushed out of history a little bit because of the damage that it did to Gerald McClellan. But Nigel Benn that night in 1995, February 1995, was absolutely phenomenal. And that has to go down as not only one of the best performances, but also a fairly serious upset.
Yeah. Well, in September 2001, I was in Madison Square Garden for Bernard Hopkins beating Felix Trinidad, which, like you say, John, we've kind of got the airbrush out with that and thinks, because Hopkins has gone on to dominate and even move up in weight. But at the time, he was seen as the old codger of the middleweight division, and Trinidad was coming up through the weights, and Hopkins was ready to be taken, to the extent where our old mate Don King had this tournament that, was ultimately going to pair Trinidad and Hopkins in the final. And they'd actually already engraved Trinidad's name on the trophy. And someone had to go and get that trophy before the final bell and start scribbling out Trinidad's name and put Hopkins's over the top. So, that's got to be up there for me. And I think the thing, what was staggering about that was, in some ways, similar to the Tyson-Douglas one, in the sense that, after three or four rounds, you could see the beatdown actually coming and it just unfolded in front of your eyes and kind of like Tyson, Trinidad had that equalizer, and you kind of knew that it would only take one shot, but it was just getting further and further away from landing until ultimately, like Buster Douglas, Bernard Hopkins put the exclamation mark on his performance and stopped Trinidad in what I think was actually the 12th round.
Yeah. I mean, Holyfield beating Tyson in the first fight, that's right there, isn't it, as well? At the time, I mean, you look back on it and it doesn't seem such a sensation, but it really was at the time, because most people thought Holyfield shouldn't be getting in the ring at all, on medical grounds almost at that time.
Yeah, and I think people thought it was more likely he was going to have a heart attack than beat
yeah,
twice.
That's all that stuff was going on. Yeah, and he goes out there, he's not intimidated a bit, and, you know, wins the fight hands down. I mean, Reg Guttridge had that great line, didn't he? You know, it's the greatest upset in the fight game, bar none. You know, it's one of Reg's great lines. He was doing that one. Yeah, that was another one I missed.
By the way, did either of you do Foreman Moore?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, I did that for Sky. Yeah, I did. When he was 45 and regained the title, that was incredible, wasn't it?
It was an amazing night, that one. The atmosphere down there. It was at the Thomas and Mack Centre, wasn't it, Ian, that one? It wasn't on the...
Well, do you know what? Memory fails me. I find it hard to separate all those Vegas venues. I always remember the Caesars Palace one, because that's the first one I ever covered a fight at, Ali against Holmes in 1980. But the others kind of merge into one a little bit. So, yeah, I couldn't answer your question there.
It was one of those where I foolishly thought, you know, looked into the night sky and thought, oh, I can just take my little walk back to the MGM or wherever it was I was staying. And when you're still walking half an hour later and you don't seem to have got any closer, you realise that's not a great move.
I remember once I was covering, we're going off on tangent a little bit here, but since we've got all day, when Marvin Hagler fought Tony Simpson in a place called Worcester, Massachusetts, and he won in six rounds and we'd all done all our stuff. So I ring routinely afterwards. I go into reception at this place called the Centrum in Worcester, ring outside, ring the taxi company. I say, could taxi come pick me up here and take me back to the Marriott Hotel? The guy goes, you had a look outside the window, buddy. I said, no, why? He goes, there's 3 feet of snow out there. There are any taxi cabs running in this town or any other in Massachusetts tonight. I had to wade. Anyway, long story short, I had to wade back through about these two. It was about 2 feet of snow. It took half a mile back to the hotel about 3 a.m.
It's all part of the glamour of the job, isn't it?
Yeah. They don't see that bit, do they? It's like walking away from the Cobo Hall in Detroit, going Tommy Hearns and Dennis Andres. Couldn't get any cars. We watched all the HBO mob leaving in stretch limousines. Me and Glenn Crory had to walk along this river in Detroit at midnight. I mean, our chances of getting there were less than 50-50. I'd say it's the murder capital of the USA.
Oh, dear. Good stuff. Hey, so Connor Mullen says, if the sport of boxing could make a New Year resolution, what should it be? Ian, let's start with you. Have you got anything?
Yep. My answer to that is get boxing back on terrestrial TV, because it's being hidden behind a paywall. And if it's hidden behind a paywall, long term, that's going to leave a big black hole with a generation growing up only interested, apparently, in these YouTube fighters and the like. So I don't know how you do it. It's going to take some financial wizardry and a lot of people compromising. But let's get the big fights, even if it's recorded highlights of the big fights, back on BBC, ITV and the like. The chances of it happening, I'd say, were, as they say, somewhere between slim and zero.
Yeah, I think that one's already gone, hasn't it? I mean, I remember doing some sort of editorial at the time on sports reports back in my radio days, and it was really just looking ahead. I don't take any great plaudits for brilliant intuition as to what's going to take place in the future, because it was fairly bloody obvious, you know. And I merely warned that by the best fights being sold to Sky, and by all the major fights being broadcast by Sky, that it was going to diminish the interest in the sport. And that, of course, is what's happened. And that goes on more and more, because that's now gone beyond Sky. We're now going on to pay-per-view on streaming services and God knows where. And it all the time gets marginalised more and more. And I think part of me thinks that boxing at the moment is in a bit of a mess, because I don't see where it's going to be 10 years from now. I think that it could be very clearly even more marginalised than it is at the moment.
Yeah, I think if I could do this if I could make a New Year's resolution, it would be for Ringside Charitable Trust and something similar to come and really start helping old fighters in need. You know, in the sense of, you know, they've got a phone line up now, but some sort of pension fund or something where there's some kind of structure in place to help fighters after the final bell. I think that would be fabulous for the sport.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea, Tris. Brilliant. Well,
I mean, it's not the first time it's been coined, but that if wave a magic wand, and I'd love that. So, Phil Ross, this is a very much over to you, gents. Here, we'd love to hear some stories about the broadcasters of the 70s, 80s, and 90s: Reg Guttridge, Harry Carpenter, and Des Lynam. This is your wheelhouse, gents. This is your time to shine.
Well, I'll kick off because Des Lynam, before he was the superstar he became on television, he used to be the commentator for the boxing on the radio, on the BBC radio, following a fairly distinguished line, which included Raymond Glendenning and Eamon Andrews, Stuart McPherson, people like that. Later, I was honoured to join that line. But I started off working with Des, and I'll just tell you one story. One of the first things we had to do together was fly to Houston to cover Pat Caldell against the ill-fated Salvador Sanchez, who was a great featherweight at the time. And we decided we would kick our heels for a few days in Houston. We went out to play golf. Neither of us at that time, got a little bit better since, neither of us really had much of a clue. And we must have landed about 9 golf balls between us on this freeway with cars going past. I mean, how we didn't break the windows of about 8 cars, I don't know. But so in the end, Des says to me, I tell you what, I think we just ought to put the clubs away and get out of here before somebody gets us. and that's how our golf game ended after about 5 holes. I mean, Des was such a supreme broadcaster, and I mean, one thing he passed on to me was, he said, I remember it was Marvin Hagler, and Hagler didn't want to do an interview at the weigh-in for the fight with Minter. And I said, oh, you know, and I'm trying to twist his arm and say, well, you know, it wouldn't hurt you to do sort of just answer a couple of questions. And Des pulled me to one side. He said, never beg for an interview. If they don't want to do it, leave it. We don't do that. So I've always remembered that.
Yeah, it's a good bit of advice, isn't it, that one? I remember Reg socially as much as through his broadcasting. He obviously did very, very many major fights, you know. I mean, his coverage of Naz was terrific. You remember those vaults over the ropes? And of course, he came out with the great line, "The ego has landed."
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember Reg from, you know, lunches in around the boxing news offices, and he'd turn up, and we'd go out, myself, Harry Mullen, who was the editor of Boxing News at the time, Reg, Bob Mee, and maybe one or two others. Sometimes once or twice, Mickey Duff dropped in as well. And, you know, the stories kicking around there were extraordinary. But I do remember Reg, of all the contributors to that little group, particularly when he got one or two glasses of wine in him, I don't think you had heard too many people in the universe swear more than Reg Guttridge did. He was beyond industrial, to the extent where Harry would say he invented a new word for the English language, which was regging. And he'd say, "John, you're regging," if we're out for a pint. And that was, to reg was to swear inappropriately in public. And Reg really could perform in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, the famous Reg story, of course, is because he lost a leg, didn't he, in the war? And he had the wooden leg, and Foreman was being really difficult with the British journalists and saying, "You guys have never been in a ring. You know what? You don't know anything about courage or bravery." And Reg got a knife and stuck it into his wooden leg. Foreman didn't know he had a wooden leg through his trousers. All the other journalists did. And Foreman spooked completely and went, "I'm getting out of here. You guys are crazy."
There was another time when he was on the beach somewhere or other. He'd gone on an away trip, Reg, and of course he'd got his, as Ian told you, he'd got his false leg, he got his peg leg. Yeah. Well, he went into the sea and he took this thing off and came hopping out of the water shouting, "Shark! Shark! Shark!"
I didn't know Harry so well. We used to see each other around ringside. It's worth remembering about Harry. He wasn't just a boxing commentator. He fronted the Wimbledon coverage on BBC television for many, many years. What I can tell you was he was quite bitter at the end about the BBC not giving him another contract when he, I think he was only about 63. I think he wanted to carry on, and he confided to me. He said, look, I don't want to stop here. He'd been an absolutely fantastic, legendary guy for the BBC to have, in the vintage days when they had just about all the sport that mattered. So he was a wonderful broadcaster, but I remember he could get worked up about if he didn't agree with the verdict in the fight. I mean, you heard it at the end of the Bugner Bruno thing, which we've discussed in another episode, but I remember him putting a huge red line through his notes on some fight where he didn't agree with the decision, screwing it up and throwing away the notes. So he felt strongly about it all. But I mean, he operated too. I think it's worth remembering this, that Harry had to work on his own because that's how the BBC did it. They didn't have a co-commentator like John and I have had all these years. So there wasn't like a second opinion. So it was quite easy for you to go wrong calling a fight where you don't know what the cards are, and it's just your view of it. I always found like I was grateful to have a second opinion to come in to maybe just temper the way I was seeing it or make me think of other aspects. I don't know what you think, John.
Yeah, well, when I first made the serious crossover from radio to television, I remember being told that by one of my producers, because commentating on radio, in a way, you're doing what you said Harry used to do, Ian. You're talking in the days, the way we used to do it in those days was you'd talk for 3 minutes, interpret what's going on, give your view as to who might have won the fight, and that's where it left it. And then you'd have one of the summarizers coming in between rounds, be it Henry Cooper or whoever. And he'd say, "Well, yeah. I think you perhaps got it right there, or maybe. I think I'll give it a draw, And you don't give things a draw, do you? But I was told when I went over to TV that I was committing myself too much, and they were basically saying to me, "Look, you don't need to do that. If somebody's going to get it wrong, don't you get it wrong. Let your summariser get it wrong."
Yeah, not getting it wrong, though. I always used to say that to people, that sometimes you'd hear people say, "Well, you thought, I said, "I don't think I got it wrong. I think the judges did." So I said, "It's only an alternative opinion." And that's where boxing commentary is difficult, because what you said, John, is absolutely spot on. You've got to give the viewers or listeners an idea of who you think is winning the fight. Oh, I mean, nowadays it does tend to be, so whoever the co-commentator is has a scorecard, so you can kind of leave it to them. But I don't want to hear a commentator who doesn't have any kind of view on, the main commentator on what they're going on in front of them. So, those three people that have been picked out there by Phil Ross, I think, we could tell stories. We could probably do a whole episode about them alone. All absolutely brilliant broadcasters.
There's two stories I could give, which I wouldn't put on air as well. When you know these guys reasonably well, there's one or two stories which kick around from years ago and you kind of think, well, they'd better just rest in history.
Yeah. Well, there are one or two stories about you and me, John, as well, and maybe Tris as well, which we'll brush under the carpet.
Let me ask one more while we're talking about those three, in particular just about Harry Carpenter, because I think we had more anecdotes for the others. Harry was obviously had this very endearing relationship with Frank Bruno. How much did that help his career, having the nation's sweetheart on side?
I think he was already a big name before that. I think he was a household name already before Frank Bruno came along.
He'd been a household name with Muhammad Ali, hadn't he? I mean, Harry had been over to the training camps, and he knew Ali really, really well. And it wasn't an invented special relationship that he had. He genuinely was, you know. And you hear one or two of our veteran written media people talking about their special relationship with Muhammad Ali. But I tell you what, they kind of, some of those have been to a degree a little bit invented. And the real relationship, I think, of that time was Harry Carpenter. He knew Ali as well as anybody.
And Reg did too. I think, didn't Ali visit Reg in hospital?
He did, when he had his heart attack.
Yeah. So there you go. I mean, he just loved Great Britain. He loved the UK, Ali. So he definitely very much liked the reporters and broadcasters from Great Britain, to the extent, I think, that Colin Hart and a colleague, I can't remember who it was.
Alan Hubbard.
Ken Jones turned up at the training camp, Deer Lake, in the middle of the night because they'd missed the press conference and they'd missed airline connections. And Ali got up in the middle of the night to talk to them, to give them quotes, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Brilliant, great isn't stuff. It? So next one, John Conahan says, I'd like to hear your collective take on the number of weight divisions. Which ones should stay or be dropped, and should any more be added? Do either of you gents feel particularly strongly about this?
I think you're the expert on this, Tris.
I mean, hey, I can actually talk about this because this is something I've thought about and not discussed really before. But I think we as human beings are all growing and are all far bigger than our counterparts of the 1900s when these weight classes were formed in the late 18th century, or sorry, late 19th century. And because of that, everything needs to be shifted up a bit. Because really, you know, a middleweight now who's 11 and a half stone, that's not a middle-sized human being by any stretch. That's quite a small chap. And the same way that a heavyweight, you know, is over 14 stone four or 200 pounds for cruiserweight, that's not a particularly big chap either, a guy who's over 14 stone four. So I think that, you know, we're really bunched up at the lower end, you know, where you've got just a handful of pounds separating the straw weights and the light flyweights and so forth. And at this top end, you've got a 25 pound jump from light heavyweight to cruiserweight, and then from cruiserweight all the way up. I do think that the whole thing does need to be ripped up and started over again. And this is, you know, this is coming from a traditionalist, but someone who understands that people are built differently. I mean, look at Rocky Marciano today, compare him. He'd be way down the weight class. He'd be barely a light heavyweight.
Yeah.
You know, so I think times have changed, and we probably do need to readjust the weight classes. And in answer to John's question, I'd have fewer weight classes down at the bottom end and a few more at the top end, and space them out and have, you know, something like in the region of 10 to 12 weight categories, and try and keep it more simplified than it is today. That's my stance on it.
I can only agree, Tris, to be honest with you. I think I totally agree with you. I mean, it does seem a little bit daft. I mean, how inconsiderate of Jack Dempsey and Rocky Marciano to be so light, to stop us comparing heavyweights from different eras as effectively as we might otherwise have done. But no, being serious, yeah, you're right. And, you know, it's probably why, Tris, you should be on some very important committee running on changing boxing. I'm serious.
I'm on the charitable committees, the Ringside Charitable Trust and Lisa McClellan's Ring of Brotherhood. But I don't think anyone with any clout wants to hear from someone who's got their own opinions, unfortunately. But still, I digress. We've got one here from Loz Berridge here, who says, "How do we get back to the mainstream? How do we get back to getting the mainstream sports boxing fan to know who the real fighters are? In the 80s, 90s, everyone knew who Leonard Hagler, Duran, Hearns were. Today, nobody knows the top fighters outside the three or four heavyweights. Short-term pain, short-term paywall gains ultimately kill boxing. What are your thoughts? I mean, we already touched upon this, but it was depressing. And I knew this going out to Spence Crawford last year. And there is this sort of little test where you can say it, whether you're in the barbers or speaking to people in the gym or whoever it is. And they say, oh, what fight are you going to cover? And you say Spence Crawford. I knew that no one was going to have a clue who I was going to see in terms of casual boxing fans. And they didn't. None of my friends knew who I was going to see when I said Spence Crawford. So the point here made by Loz is something that I saw with my own two eyes. How do we get it back, gents?
I don't think you can. I mean, it might sound very, very gloomy, but I think the days when we all sit, 10 million of us watching a TV channel, are to an extent gone. You occasionally get an amazing story which comes through, like in the darts recently, when young Luke Littler played his way through at the age of 16 into the World Darts Final. And that got him onto the front page of national newspapers and created record viewing figures. I mean, I think if you get one extraordinary performance coming through, then that can be something which will bring the sport international recognition, as indeed that young lad did, albeit on a slightly smaller scale with darts as against boxing. But, you know, so far as boxing's concerned, we've got so many people with their nose in the trough financially. Are they really going to back away and say, oh, this ain't really working? It's the only thing which is putting those big fights on now is yet more money coming in from Saudi.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ian, it's a fair point, and we sort of did address it. I mean, even now with the Saudi thing, I do wonder, and it made me wonder about this with that December 23rd show, the heavyweight show in Saudi, is I'm not sure how much this is moving the needle in America. There was rumors that the Fury and Ngannou fight did just a few thousand pay-per-views in America when it was supposed to be a crossover Goliath of a pay-per-view. I don't know. I don't know how you get to this point where these people become household names. You know, we've had successful Olympic cycles as well, but even the Olympians aren't really crossing over any longer.
Well, I mean, I think one of the most worrying aspects, and John's right, I don't think you can change history now. Things are changing and changing fast. It'll never be like it used to be in those 70s, 80s, 90s days that we keep on banging on about. I mean, I think you've got a major problem. You've got KSI fighting Logan Paul and getting 1.3 million pay-per-view sales. You know, KSA against Joe Weller selling out the Copper Box Arena. These are people who, without being too unkind, really can't fight very much at all. But if you're under 25, and I know quite a few kids who are under 25, and they're into this. They love all this. They've never heard of Terence Crawford. They probably never heard of Marvin Hagler and Sugar Ray Leonard. They just about heard of Mike Tyson. And the sport's dying in America. It has been for a long time. And if you want to know where it all leads to, if everything's pay-per-view, it's where it is in America, where a whole generation has grown up having never seen the sport. People have got to see the sport. So going back to my previous answer, I refer you to my previous answer about you've got to get it back on the main channels. Otherwise, people won't have any interest in it. But, you know, I suppose one saving grace in all this is if they want to watch KSI and Logan Paul and all that kind of thing, at least they're kind of interested in boxing. So how do we educate the kids who love boxing because of the narrative and the soap opera around those guys to go, yeah, that's really good, but it's like minor counties against the Ashes series in cricket. You know, if you're interested in that, you're going to love this. So how you make that change, how you educate another generation to say, look, it can be fantastic, this sport, check this out.
It's a mistake as well, Ian, isn't it, to sort of say, well, do it through the newspapers, because newspapers aren't what they were either. They're tiny compared with 30 years ago, they don't have the impact. They have very little impact at all. The real impact comes, as you've just said, through social media. And it's a question of getting the right messages going across from promoters, from governing bodies, et cetera, to actually make people realize that these proper fights outrank some of the dross, which is bringing in so much money now. I mean, it's preposterous, isn't it? And I don't mean this. I've got nothing against Tommy Fury, nothing at all. But it's preposterous to say that he is arguably the third best paid fighter in the UK. Because he's not even British title level, nowhere near.
Yeah, that's where we are, though. That's where we are. I mean, and us three can sound really like dinosaurs, you know, out of touch old guys. I mean, Tris is not so old. John is a little bit younger than me. But, you know, look, somehow we've got to address the era that we're in if boxing is to thrive and carry on thriving. Yeah, it's big if Tyson Fury meets AJ, if he ever does. That's going to be a massive fight, and there'll be 7 pages in the paper every day. But what about the mainstream of the sport on a week-by-week basis? That's what we're talking about. And I wish we had a few more answers and a few less questions.
Well, by the way, we've got
one coming up very soon, haven't we? Callum Smith against Beterbiev. You know, Callum, that is a massive fight for Callum Smith. But if you went and talked to most people, if you went and walked down Regent Street and said, what do you think about this? You'd get a load of blank looks. And I'm not just talking about people who obviously would have no interest in boxing. I mean, you could go to young, sporty-looking, athletic men and women, and they wouldn't know what you're on about. That's a proper fight and a life-changer, potentially, for Callum Smith. But outside Merseyside, does it rank? I'm afraid not.
Hey, by the way, it's interesting, this. I think one of the things that's also hurting the sport is the lack of activity from the stars. You know, Terence Crawford fought once this year. Fury has fought, once in about 2 years? I mean, Dillian White and the Chisora and then Ngannou. They're not active enough. And, you know, I remember Frank Warren saying to me years ago, he wanted the guys to get 4 fights a year so that they were in a news cycle 4 times a year, basically every quarter, so that you had a week or two in the build up and a week in the aftermath, and therefore they were in the news cycle for about 20-25 weeks of the calendar year. Now they emerge for a couple of days before a fight and disappear.
Well, with the late Vic Wakeling, who used to be my boss at Sky Sports, you know, we had a lot of frank exchanges about things, but his idea, you know, I didn't always agree with it, was we will have boxing on every single Saturday night, come what may, at 10 o'clock. And we did. It didn't matter what the quality of the show was, but that kind of did turn people on a bit, I think, to boxing. They knew they could turn on Sky Sports on a Saturday night at 10 and there'd be boxing on. It might be from the Harvey Haddon Leisure Centre in Nottingham 1 week. Another week, it might be a very big, very big fight. But we got to a stage there where there were enough people tuning into the boxing that we built Ricky Hatton away from terrestrial TV into a megastar. So something was going on. So keep the sport in front of as many people as you can, and don't make every other fight a pay-per-view thing, because quite a few of them just aren't pay-per-view events and not that kind of quality. But the promoters, well, they're not going to change it, are they?
So next one, and we've touched upon this earlier, from Sweet Pugilism. If Callum Smith were to beat Artur Beterbiev out in Canada, where does it rank in the all-time upsets from British fighters and world title fights? And what are your top 5? I think maybe we should say this, do this on the road, maybe in terms of title fights abroad. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah.
But obviously, I mean, the undisputed king for that is Lloyd Hannigan and
Don Curry. I mean, Minter beat Antua Firmo, didn't he, in Las Vegas? That was a big win at the time. Not that Antua Firmo was fantastic shakes, but he had, at least on paper, drawn with Marvin Hagler before
Stracy and Napoles.
Napoles was a huge one. Yeah, I mean, Napoles was probably a bit past his best, but a sensation really for John H. Tracy to go over there and beat a legend.
I think a massive world title upset over here, just maybe redefining the question slightly, had to be Randolph Turpin beating Sugar Ray Robinson, didn't it? Back in, what was it, 1951. You know, I mean, Robinson was pretty much on a tour of Europe with his entourage. He even took his personal comedian and his personal hairdresser over there. 21 people travelled around. And I don't think he really trained for that first fight against Turpin. Turpin was big, strong, rugged, and he bashed him up. Next time they fought, it was a very different story because Robinson then took it seriously. But that was a big one. And I think you've got to include as well, haven't you, Tyson Fury beating Vladimir Klitschko when he did. Because Klitschko at the time was ruling the heavyweight division. And I don't think too many people seriously gave Tyson Fury a great chance of winning that one. But he devised a strategy with his trainer and he went out there and he did it.
Yeah. Hey, how about Kirkland Lang Duran? Where would you put that?
Yeah. Well, none of us were at that fight. That's amazing. I remember being in the sports room at BBC Radio and it came up on a teleprinter, like from nowhere. We'd all even forgotten the fight was happening. Oh, Kirkland Lang's fighting Roberto Duran. Well, you know, he's not going to beat Roberto Duran, even if Duran's, you know, like a beach whale at the moment. And then, the result came through on a teleprinter. I'm telling the rest of the sports editor, I'm going, we got to leave with this. I said, Kirkland Lang's beating Roberto Duran. But you know what? Even then, like, I got some blank looks around the office. Well, no, I'm not going to lead with it. But yeah, all right, do us a minute piece on that. So it was, that's right up there. That's amazing, isn't it, when you think of it? Kirkland Lang beat Roberto Duran.
And then he went missing, didn't he?
He'd been taken in as a body, hadn't he? You know, Mickey Duff had sort of wheeled him, had managed to maneuver him into this fight. And they were trying to relaunch Duran and get him back as a genuine world title force. And the idea was that Lang was going to be the easy, easy victory for him to help rehabilitate. My goodness, didn't they get that wrong? It was actually a split decision, if you remember, Ian, but there was nothing split about it. If you dig that fight out, Duran was beaten fairly handily by Lang, and it just makes you realise how good Kirkland might have been if he'd had a different attitude.
Well, yeah, if he could have concentrated. I remember Terry Lawless used to send him out, you know, the second Colin Jones fight. I remember he was shouting at him. He was banging him on the backside as he went out the corner. Concentrate, Kirk! Just concentrate! We've got this! Didn't, you know, he'd taken out in the ninth round again, setting a switch off. I mean, he would drive you, he would have driven you mad, but he had an enormous level of ability when he put his mind to it. And he obviously did, you know, is there any footage of that fight? I've never seen it. Have you seen it?
I think it is there somewhere on YouTube. I think you can dig it out, but it never gets any sort of prominence, does it? And it didn't at the time.
What about Danny Williams? I know Mike Tyson was on the downslide in a pretty big way by then. Danny Williams beating Mike Tyson in Louisville. I mean, Danny Williams had been hired, I know this, by Showtime because they thought he was an absolute no-hoper, even for a faded Tyson. I remember Jay Larkin, the late Jay Larkin, who was the boss at Showtime, pulling me to one side on the night of the fight because he was worried because Tyson owed Showtime a load of money and saying to me, this Danny Williams, he goes, we don't have a problem with him, do we? There's no, he can't fight, can he? I said, he can. I said, he can, Jay. He can fight. I said, but he said he'll be a nervous wreck. I said, and Mike will probably blow him away. But if you're asking me if he can fight, he really can. Of course, he won. He got through the first two rounds, stopped him in four rounds. There was a tornado going, or was a tornado warning going on outside the arena.
I mean, in terms of the Brits as well, I mean, with, again, hindsight and airbrushing history, got to remember, the world and his wife picked Jeff Lacey to starch Calzaghe.
Yeah. Certainly the Americans thought, you know, HBO thought that, didn't they? It was a big moment for Jeff Lacey.
Go on. Sorry, John.
Sorry, go on. I was just going to say they thought I was nuts in the run-up to that because having seen Lacey fight previously, I kind of thought that he was made for Joe because although he's a big puncher and he looked intimidating, he was slow. And that was the key. And I remember being interviewed, and they couldn't believe what they were hearing when I said, "Well, I actually think that I think Joe Calzaghe is going to win this one fairly handily, and I believe it very strongly." And they'd sort of built themselves up as thinking that Lacey was the new great force of the middleweight super middleweight division. And Joe didn't read the script, did he?
He didn't. I mean, and HBO also believed Michael Grant was probably going to beat Lennox Lewis. Couldn't have been more wrong about that either.
not a great call, was it?
No.
Okay.
No, I'd seen Lacey, like you, John, I'd seen Lacey quite a bit on American undercards before that and never formed the opinion that he was any kind of superstar. Useful, but probably not in Calzaghe's class. Well, we know he wasn't in Calzaghe's class, don't we?
So last two or three, gents, and then we'll wrap it. By the way, it looks like people really did enjoy the Dream Fight stuff. I think there's definitely more that we can do with that because Arsenal 82 Dan has said this, absolutely brilliant episode of Ringside Rewind on Dream Fights. I've always wondered how a Chris Eubank, Gerald McClellan fight would have panned out. Also, and this isn't the question, but Froch McClellan, granite chin versus huge puncher. Oh, thoughts. What are your thoughts? So either Froch McClellan or Chris Eubank, Gerald McClellan. By the way, Anish Parekh says, thinking about Froch McClellan makes me wince. I mean, does, doesn't it? But yes, McClellan against either Eubank or Froch.
I think Froch might have been naturally too big for McClellan. I mean, and whatever you think about Carl, he really was a warrior. He relished those kind of battles. He wouldn't be backing down. So I'm kind of leaning towards Froch, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I'd have fancied Froch in that one. I think McClellan, for all the fact that he was a murderous puncher, he really was one of the great punchers of our time in the sport. I think you've got to give respect to the granite chin and the durability and the sheer will to win that Carl Froch had. You know, remember some of his great performances. And I think he'd have found another one against Gerald McClellan.
Yeah. I've got a feeling McClellan might have been a bit too busy for Eubank, though.
I mean, Eubank never got a big name in America, did he?
On point.
Yeah. John?
Yeah. Eubank was brilliantly promoted, wasn't he? They kept him away from Roy Jones. They kept him away from Harold Graham, you know, people who could move. And like Ian says, people who were busy. I don't think for a moment that McClellan would have knocked him out, but I'm not sure that Eubank would have had the speed and the technical ability to have got to him.
Yeah.
That's the one thing we didn't get.
On points, twisted my arm on that one, I think. But, you know, we're only guessing. It's fun, though. We like these guesses. We'll do more of these dream fights.
I mean, but that's
everybody has an opinion.
Eubank and Ben are both on the ballot for the Hall of Fame, and neither have got in. In fact, Jane Couch and Ricky Hatton have obviously gone in. John, you've been held over another year as well.
Talking of people who didn't.
I never even got nominated.
Well, there's still time. Not this year. Yeah. There's not anyway. Anyway, but the one thing lacking from Eubank's record is a big name American, isn't it? And you know, Ben has Iron Barkley, DeWitt, and McClellan. That's real pedigree on his record. And
yeah, I mean, Eubank never took
that step.
He used to say, Tris, Nigel always used to say to me in interviews, "I'm never going to lose to an American." It was a big thing with him, really big thing.
So, okay, a couple more. So, Bob Keane says this. Interesting one. I have thought about this a couple of times, but looking at the timeline, it becomes a little bit clearer. But Bob Keane asks, no one ever talks about why Lennox Lewis and Michael Moore never fought. I know it would have been a comfortable victory for Lennox, but it's a missing name on his CV, and I've never heard an explanation as to why it never happened. Do you have any insight?
Moore was too fragile, wasn't he? I don't think he would have had credibility. He managed to get the WBO title, and he was good enough as a young and quicker fighter to share a ring with George Foreman and to fight against Evander Holyfield. But I don't think you know, I mean, we were around at the time, and I don't see, and I don't think that there would have been credibility in him fighting Lennox Lewis. No. I think everybody who was close to the sport knew that Lennox would have simply been much too much for him.
Yeah, I mean, the fight really that you wonder about, and we've mentioned it a million times, is, you know, Lennox Lewis against Riddick Bowe. That should have happened. Bowe's camp never wanted it. Lewis Mora, yeah, I suppose it could have been one of the routine defences that came along somewhere along the line. Personal view is that Lennox would have stopped him.
I think when you look at Michael Mora's career, obviously there was the big loss we've touched upon to George Foreman in the end of 94. So that really put him on ice and he was rebuilding there. There was a couple of rebuilding wins with Axel Schultz and Franz Botha and Warren Bean, who he beat by a majority decision. But then he got stopped and was down several times against Evander Holyfield. And then he was sort of rebuilding again. So he didn't really go to a title shot with Lennox then. And then he was chinned in about 30 seconds by David Tuer. So it just, you know, I think if he'd maintained an unbeaten run and maybe if he hadn't had the Holyfield fight, he could have gone that direction into Lewis. But I don't think after the stoppage loss to Foreman, he needed to rebuild. After the loss to Holyfield, he needed to rebuild. And then he had inactivity. I think after the Holyfield fight, he didn't fight for 2 or 3 years anyway.
Mora versus Herbie Hyde, anybody?
Sorry, Herbie Hyde.
Mora versus Hyde.
Yeah.
Potential for explosive. Definitely. But I think Mora was too sophisticated, wasn't he? I think he was too good. And he was certainly a lethal light heavyweight, but he was also no mean heavyweight, and obviously the first ever Southpaw World Heavyweight Champion, of which we've had a whole bunch since.
I don't think it was a great clamour, was it, if we're being honest, to see Lennox Lewis, Michael Mora, if we're honest.
We're going to have one last one here. This is from JJA7. Just for you gents, because you covered him far more than me. Where is Prince Naz on the list of Britain's best ever fighters, and should he have achieved more? John.
I think he should have achieved more. I think his big mistake was coming away from Brandon Ingle. I don't think he was ever quite the same man when he moved away from him. And he was kind of talked into the belief that he was this phenomenal puncher. And I think, yes, he could punch, but I think it was his reflexes and his incredibly elusive style which served him so well in the early days, and once he moved away from that, the story was kind of not there anymore, and he was well and truly found out by Marco Antonio Barrera. Yeah, he was very, very good, but I think that he could have been better had he you know, sort of concentrated on the basics and remembered what had made him a great fighter in the first place. He could have been a great deal more.
Yeah, I think I'd go along with that. He obviously could have done more. I think his career did start to go downhill when he left Brendan Ingle and when he went to America as well, where he kind of was in a fight that really helped him to take off there. That Kevin Kelly, that up and down, I can't remember how many knockdowns. But I think that fight also put him in touch, or maybe made him lose the belief in his own invincibility. I remember him sitting in the dressing room after that fight and thinking, yeah, things can go wrong. I could get beaten. That could have gone another way. And yeah, other things as well. So he could have done more, but you know what? When you look back on it now, he was exciting and he was explosive and he was around for a fair bit of time and he made a great deal of money, enough money to be having a house on Wentworth Golf Course. So he didn't do too bad. I mean, he's not up there with people like Ted Kidd Lewis and Jimmy Wild or Joe Calzaghe or Lennox Lewis. But yeah, he's probably in the top 10 greatest fighters, isn't he, of all time?
Was that being from the UK? Yeah, John?
Yeah, maybe. I think you just have to remember him for what he brought in. He was one of those fighters who had crossover appeal, didn't he? He appealed to more than just fight fans. I remember going to his contests and seeing the sort of people there who you'd normally see at rock concerts. You wouldn't see them at fights. And he had a crossover appeal, men and women as well. And he was massive for that reason, and he was great box office in the early stages. You know, he produced some phenomenal performances, and he could be very difficult to deal with, but he was also great fun.
Imagine just how many pay-per-view sales there'd be if they put Prince Nassim Hammad in with KSI.
Probably still could.
You saying all that, John, and you're spot on about his crossover appeal to all generations. He's exactly the kind of guy we need to come along now and who would have that kind of appeal. That's the kind of fighter you need to work with. That's what the kids want, something like that. So maybe us oldies have got to get plugged into all that.
I know what they want. You've talked about KSI, we've talked about Tommy Fury, and I think you mentioned Joe Weller, Ian. I think what we need is Dark v. Rawling at the Copper Box.
And maybe we can
pipe in the crowd noise as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been noted as a puncher, but, you know, the jab could do the job. Isn't this where we start doing a lot of trash talking for each, to build up to get pay-per-view sales going?
Oh God, that's a separate episode. Surely we can lead into this. But John, how much money would you charge the Saudis to fight Ian Dark?
I think there's some marketability in it. You know, the battle of the old guys. Who's going to take it?
Yeah, then we can go on from all that. And you know, would Desmond Lynam have beaten Harry Carpenter? You know.
You could come down and commentate in between rounds. You could come and do snippets as to how you're breaking the fight down.
Well, this is you're opening up a whole new market on TikTok and all that. People who commentate on their own fights while they're fighting. See, let's see where we could take this thing.
I think, do you know what? I think Floyd actually did that in some of his fights. I think he was shouting some stuff to Jim Lampley in some of his early fights, telling him and responding to Jim Lampley's calls mid-fight in some of his early fights. I could see you guys doing that. That would be hilarious. But I think that would do well in the Copper Box, you know? I think we could make it happen. Maybe I should promote.
Reach into your pockets and promote it then, Triz.
Yeah.
Okay, five reach.
Once we're finished with this, I'm going straight into training. I'm going to be ready. I'm going to be in the shape of my life for this.
You don't need to be.
Gents, it's been a lot of fun, as always. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Guys, it's been great to be back doing Ringside Rewind. If you could possibly leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, that would be enormously appreciated from all of us. But that's enough for today from myself, Tris Dixon, John Rawling and Ian Dark. And we'll be back soon.
Happy New Year.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.